is learning how to think theologically, thinking problems through, learning method, learning. Now, it seems that the way courses are set up, you can't accomplish both coverage and method. So what you have to try to do is a hybrid. You have to try to accomplish some of both. Learning how to think theologically, thinking problems through, learning method. So what you have to try to do is a hybrid. You have to try to accomplish some of both. You haven't even had time to think about it. And I understand that. I'm fully aware of that, and I agonize over that. However, there's no way to cover and really think deeply about every question in theology. In fact, what happens is, as you learn method, which is very important because when you're out in your ministry somewhere, you're not going to have anybody there, for the most part, to interact with on the same level as you are. Once in a while, you'll get into a good ministerium and you'll be able to talk with fellow evangelical ministers about theological questions, but you'll even have very little time to do that. And you won't have opportunity to do that with people in your own congregation. They'll be on another level, and you'll be seeking to minister to them. So it becomes a very real problem. And most of your thinking should be done while you're in seminary. You don't stop thinking, but you actively involve yourself with these questions. So we haven't been able to come up with a solution to this, and I must apologize, although I don't know any way out, for the way that we've had to superficially cover some of these matters. The syllabus has helped. That is, the syllabus provides a residue, so that even if we have to skip over some things, a lot of material has been put into the syllabus, which will help you to interact with the basic questions and some of the materials. So I trust that that has been and will be some help to you in days to come. But the question of method is a very sticky one. I don't know how to solve it. In years past, we've worked hard on method and haven't gotten coverage. And this year, we've had, for both 1 and 2, a rather extensive syllabus, and we've had a lot of coverage, but we haven't done a lot with method. And that's a problem. Again, I don't know how to solve it. Some things we spend a fair amount of time on, and for some people, it's too much time. For other people, it's just the right amount of time. For other people, it's not enough. They still have questions they want to think through. There is no way to pitch the teaching so that everybody will be satisfied that we're going about at about the right rate. And as a result, for some people, they get bored, and it's not challenging anymore. For other people, it's too fast. You're going too quickly for me. I can't keep up. My thinking isn't with you. For other people, it's going just about right. Again, I don't know how to pitch it except somewhere at the middle. And that means that nobody except the people in the middle will be satisfied. The people who are, for whom it's going too rapidly, they're not satisfied. The people for whom it's boring, they're not satisfied. They want to press on. Why do we have to fool with these questions? Why do we have to have questions from the class? Why do we have to have people thinking through things? Let's just move on. But the problem with that is that really this is the place in which you ought to be thinking through these theological questions, and the place at which you have opportunity to interact with them. So I hope that you will understand the size of the problem. And if this is your middler year, and you'll be taking 3 and 4 next year, there will be opportunity for more interaction of a methodological nature, Lord willing, next year. Although even there I can't promise anything, because I'm going to try to produce a new syllabus for Systematics 3. And hopefully Systematics 4 will have a syllabus one of these days as well. It's just one of those problems. I am open to suggestions, but I've struggled with this for quite a few years, and I haven't come up with any solution. The syllabus itself is a problem, because the syllabus tends to lend itself toward a feeling of a lack of need to really come to grips with problems. If you don't have a syllabus, you merely present problems, you lay out things, people start thinking through the problems with you. They don't have all that material in front of them. And they really have to think step by step to get to a solution. Whereas in the syllabus, someone just looks down and says, oh, there's the answer. Go on. It costs no effort. It costs no effort. And that's a problem. But again, it leaves a residue. Again, how are you going to accomplish both purposes? I don't know. So it's very unsatisfying to me personally. I would like to take 16 years and then go through systematics once in the 16 years. That can't be done, obviously. Obviously. I'd like to take a whole semester just on eschatology. I'd like to take a whole semester on the attributes of God. Can't be done. So there we are. We're trying to do everything in four courses. It's ridiculous. Someone says, why don't you have more hours in systematics? Great, I'd like that. Someone else says, well, then you'd have to have more hours in Old Testament, more in New Testament, more in historical courses, and more in practical courses. And you probably want to add a few other courses that we don't have already. Well, where do you end? You could run a four-year program. We could go to that. For some, that would mean 7 years. And that's no joke, because some are now taking the 3 years in five. I really don't know the solution to that. We've gone over this as a faculty again and again and again, and there doesn't appear to be any solution to it. So I'm merely asking, I think, for understanding of something of the size of the problem. All right, enough said for that. The nature of sin. Here are some statements from the Westminster Larger Catechism, the Second Helvetic Confession, and then a development of the doctrine. First, sin may be defined both positively and negatively as transgression of the law of God and as a want of conformity to it. On page 78, here are some words which Archbishop Trench gives us, Greek words which are translated sin. And of course they have various kinds of connotations as well as denotations. Let me quickly put them on the board and you can fill them in. There should be such a rich vocabulary in Scripture for sin. Sin has so many forms, so many ramifications. Now you notice that we mentioned as a very interesting word, agnoemon. We might notice, going back to Leviticus chapter 4, the Old Testament emphasis in the classic passage. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and commits any of them, and then it goes on to say, what shall be done? Atonement is needed for sins unintentionally committed, ignorantly committed. Verse 13, now if the whole congregation of Israel commits error, and the matter escapes the notice of the assembly, and they commit any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and they become guilty, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, then the assembly shall offer a bull of the herd for a sin offering and bring it before the tent of meeting. Verse 20, he shall also do with the bull just as he did with the bull of the sin offering, thus he shall do with it, so the priest shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. Then he is to bring out the bull to a place outside the camp and burn it as he burned the first bull. It is the sin offering for the assembly. Then it goes on. Whenever a leader sins and unintentionally does any one of all the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done, and he becomes guilty, if his sin which he has committed is made known to him, and then it goes on down through verse 29. This requires atonement. It requires atonement. Verse 27, if any one of the common people sins unintentionally in doing any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done and becomes guilty. Notice he does it intentionally, but this involves guilt and requires atonement. And then verse 35, he shall remove all its fat, just as the fat of the lamb is removed from the sacrifice of the peace offering, and the priest shall offer them up in smoke on the altar on the offerings by fire to the Lord. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him in regard to his sin which he has committed, and he shall be forgiven. Sins of ignorance are included in this listing of kinds of ideas of sin in regard to its nature. Now, sin may be distinguished as principle as well as action. Paul, for example, speaks of the sin principle, particularly in Romans 6. Our Lord distinguishes between what a man is and what he brings forth, between a man's character and his conduct. He asserts that there is an organic connection between the two. What a man is, what a man does. A man does what he is. So, conduct is related very definitely to character. Sin includes both guilt and corruption. Number three, guilt refers to man's legal standing as a sinner before the law of God. Corruption refers to man's sinful moral character contrasted with the moral character of God. Sometimes that distinction is spoken of in terms of standing and state, or position and condition. Those terms are sometimes employed. Standing and state, position, condition. Number four, sin may be distinguished as both original and actual. Original and actual. Original is that sin in which every man shares, both in act and in consequences, because of his relationship to Adam. Actual sin is that sin which every man, except Christ, commits in himself, that sin whose guilt and corruption are uniquely his own, not shared. Number five, sin may not be defined as a physical substance or quality. Very difficult to get away from the idea of sin as a stuff. Very difficult. Hard to think of sin not as some kind of stuff that's in your blood, or that's running around inside you, or that permeates your pores or something. Sin may not be defined simply as limitation or finitude. May not be defined as an illusion resulting from man's inadequate knowledge. Someone says, if we only had the right view of things, we only looked at it from the right perspective, sin would be non-existent. Christian scientists, for example, would welcome that position. If we had the right viewpoint, sin would not exist. Number eight, sin may not be defined as necessary antagonism. Now, that has been suggested. That is, notice the contrast. There can be no rest without fatigue. How can you have rest without fatigue? There can be no life without death. There can be no light without darkness. There can be no good without evil. So evil's necessary. Necessary antagonism. Sin is the necessary condition of the existence of virtue. That has been proposed. And sometimes evangelicals have fallen into that kind of language without realizing it. This theory makes evil a good. It destroys moral consciousness. It makes all the denunciations of the Bible against sin meaningless, and virtually makes God the author of evil that good may come. Sin as necessary antagonism. The basic problem is a confusion between epistemology and metaphysics. The basic problem here is that people feel you can't define good without evil. And that's epistemology. But then the confusion comes when they pass over from epistemology into metaphysics or ontology and say you can't have good without having evil. See, there's a jump from epistemology to metaphysics, from knowing to being, from one realm to another. And you can see how there's a problem of definition, but don't carry the problem of definition over into the problem of being. That's where the problem comes here. Number nine, sin may not be defined merely as self-love arising from the natural development of the appetites before the development of the reason. If you want to read a fascinating account of the origin of sin, read Finney. Sin is necessary. Sin is necessary. It's a necessary part of a child's development. Before the reason has opportunity to develop sufficiently to counterbalance them, the appetites develop to such a degree that they take the stronger hold upon the will, resulting in the will's gratification of the appetites rather than of the, reason. Would you correct that, please? In 9A, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th line, where it says, rather than of the will, that should be reason. Gratification of the appetites rather than of the reason. See, it's not the will's gratification of the will. It's the will's gratification of the appetites rather than of the reason. Number 10. The essence of sin cannot be reduced to any one principle, whether of selfishness or of self-will. That is admittedly argumentative. Admittedly so. Because some people feel that the essence of sin is selfishness. That's really the essence of it. The heart of it. That's what sin is at the heart of it. Selfishness must be defined not simply as self-love, which has a proper place. You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. Self-love has a proper place. In fact, in a sense, you cannot really understand or properly define love to the neighbor apart from a proper understanding of self-love. So it must be defined not merely as self-love, but as the undue preference of our own happiness, advantage, welfare, or comfort to that of others. Now, if you define selfishness in that way, notice, sometimes parents do violate the law of God to benefit their children. This violation is sin, but it is not an instance of selfishness. Again, I developed that a little bit. You could possibly consider that selfishness in the sense that it's an indirect way of benefiting the parents. The problem is that explanation goes too far, because in this case, all good acts become selfish. All good acts become selfish, because good acts always benefit the doer in some way, always. So you must be very careful what you do with that. In the case of the parents, the question is, what is their motive? And I mean the leading motive, since motives are always complex. If it is the happiness, the advantage, the welfare, the comfort of their children, then the action, even though it is sin, that is stealing food, even though it is sin, it is not selfish. Mr. Moore cannot be reduced to any one principle. That it may be necessary to propose two or three or four principles. That's all. That's the whole brunt of this suggestion. By the way, notice self-will has sometimes been called the essence of sin, but that's a question of definition. What do you mean by self-will? If I will to do the will of God, is that self-will? Well, it's certainly the self-willing. And is that sin, if I will to do the will of God? See, now, of course, some people feel that you shouldn't will to do anything. You let God do his will through you, but you don't will to do anything. I don't really think they mean that in the final analysis. I think they do mean that their will, even by the Spirit of God's work in their hearts, is to be brought into line, into conformity with the will of God, so that they, not from their own strength or from their own power, but by the Spirit's enablement, do most willingly desire to do and decide to do the will of God. It is certainly not against their will. Mr. Warner.
Yeah,
that breaking the will of a child sometimes is used in the sense of breaking the will of the child as opposed to your will. Not breaking the will of the child as being in accordance with your will. You wouldn't want to break the child's will in that sense. If the child's will can be brought into accordance with your will, that's what you're really after. So you must be careful what you do with that concept, breaking the child's will. You probably mean breaking the will as it is in opposition to your will and primarily to the will of God. I think that's what you're talking about, yeah. Okay, Mr. Pickard. There is a problem there in terms of we really ought to treat the law of God. Yeah, no question. Another thing. We really ought to treat the law of God. The relationship of the law of God to the nature of God is a question that needs to be explored in that light. We've had a rash of writings in the area of Christian social ethics which treat the question or attempt to treat the question, what is the believer's relationship to the law of God? And a lot of terminology has come into usage. Some writers are saying they're speaking no longer of the Ten Commandments as equivalent to the moral law of God, but they're now speaking of the eternal moral law of God. And they view that as a kind of a heading, and then the Mosaic legislation as it relates to morality is one expression, one form of the eternal moral law of God. And then, say, the Golden Rule, or the two great commandments that Christ enunciated, or portions of the Sermon on the Mount, they're viewed as another expression of the eternal law of God. It's a very broad concept. Obviously, you can say that whatever is binding upon man's obedience is the law of God. You can define it that way. And in that sense, anything in the Bible that is binding upon man's obedience would have the force of law. Okay? I realize that it's an enormous subject. Well, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to treat the origin of sin and the fall of mankind. But next time we are going to finish the syllabus, whatever we do, whatever it takes. It goes to page 93. Mr. Basil. No, there's another installment. Points left in the syllabus. Number 6, the origin of sin in the fall of mankind. And number 7, the consequences of the fall. In the origin of sin, I should like to just emphasize a couple of points. I won't take the time on page 81 to put the Greek in of Romans 5:12. I'll let you do that at your convenience. Close to the bottom of the page, it says in Romans 5:12, Paul asserts, and then the Greek, dihenas anthropou, he hamartia eis tan kasman eis eilthen, should go. But just these couple of points. The question of the origin of sin always raises the prior question of the part that God and Satan play in the origin of sin. Now, if on the one hand we deny that God is in any sense the cause of original sin, we must also be careful to deny that Satan is the efficient cause or in any sense what might be called the crucially responsible cause of the origin of sin in the human race. You may speak of Satan as a sinner, as the origin of sin in the world, but if you talk about the origin of sin in the human race, then you have to bring the question down to our first parents. You can, of course, speak of Satan as a kind of a rational cause of sin, of the fall. By rational cause, I mean he provided the reason which Adam and Eve used in their self-initiated and self-determined revolt against the will of God. But there is, in a very real sense, the idea that sin in the human race is initiated and originated by Adam and Eve themselves. That is, in a sense, we ought to think of sin as being created by Adam and Eve, sin in the human race, that is, created by them from themselves. In a sense, an ex nihilo creation. Now, if you don't think of sin as a stuff, if you don't think of sin as a something, something which has weight and density and so on, if you think of sin purely in terms of this self-initiated revolution, this revolt against the will of God, then it isn't as hard to think of sin as having been created ex nihilo by Adam and Eve. To explain it is one of the great mysteries. To explain how these people, with every advantage on the side of godliness and holiness, could have initiated such a revolt against God, that seems to be beyond our ability. Certainly, we can adduce certain motives scripturally, but even those seem to fail of a full explanation as to why they should do this thing. And nevertheless, we have that situation that they did revolt against God, and so sin originates in the human race with Adam and Eve. Yeah. In the human race. If you view the origin of sin in the world as having occurred in the fall of Satan and the evil angels, no problem. But if you talk about the origin of sin in the human race, I think you can't say, he made me do it. I think you have to say, you know, Adam and Eve, they were the originators. They are responsible. Whatever you say about rational cause and so on, about responsibility of Satan in the temptation and the fall, I'm quite well aware of the principle in ethics of contributory responsibility. I'm fully aware of that. That is a principle which ought to be further explicated in Christian ethics. That is, when the Bible says, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Obviously, the children are responsible for the wrath, but the fathers are responsible for the provocation. And so you can biblically talk about contributory responsibility. There is a place for that category. And you can talk about Satan in that sense, contributory responsibility to the fall. But I think the crucial question really comes down to Adam and Eve themselves. Mr. Pratt, you could explain that in terms of both the example of following Satan, who was the originator of sin in the world, and also the yielding to the temptation which Satan presented, both ways. Mr. Pratt, in regard to Roman numeral 7, the consequences of the fall, it deals with the representative consequences as well as immediate consequences. I would note under the immediate consequences of the fall to Adam, the top half of page 83, I would note there the meaning given for spiritual death and the meaning given for physical death. I think you can establish a parallel of meaning between the two that is helpful. That is, in defining those terms theologically. We can all define physical death biologically, but if you're going to talk about physical death theologically, I think this definition may be helpful. As far as representative consequences of the fall, there is a section here under the imputation of Adam's guilt of consideration of the classic passage, Romans 5, 12 through 19, and through the next few pages, there is a running series of comments on each verse in the passage. We're not going to dwell upon that. You can do that at your own leisure. There are just four places where you need to insert something. At the bottom of page 83, where it says, one man sinned death, what you ought to do is to insert an arrow in between each of those elements. So one man arrow to sinned and then arrow to death. And the same thing with the next line under it. One, all men, arrow sinned, arrow death. So you put after one man, an arrow, sinned, an arrow, death. In the same way with all men, sin and death. And then on page 84, about three-fifths of the way down the page, under comments, two in parentheses, but if sin is not charged to one's account when there is not law, then how could the chain all men, arrow, sinned, arrow, death be the case? Same thing, all men, arrow, sin, arrow, death. And then on page 86, at the top, under two in parentheses, line two, it would appear that an order is established here. Grace, arrow, gift of righteousness, arrow, life. Arrows in the same direction. Grace, arrow, gift of righteousness, arrow, life. And I would suggest you look over this exposition as you have opportunity. But what I'd like to stress today is these five theories of the imputation of Adam's sin. You notice the five theories you might wish to underline because the one is not further indented out to the left, and that confuses a little because it looks like a block of material. You can't spot where the view begins. But notice on page 86, B1, the Pelagian theory. You might wish to underline just the title so you can quickly spot the five theories. Page 87 at the top, 2, the Arminian theory. Three-fourths of the way down, page 87, 3, the theory of mediate imputation. Near the top of page 88, 4, the theory of natural headship. And then halfway down page 88, the theory of federal headship. Now, Mr. Dixon, you can say on the one hand that he chose not to, but that's not a very satisfying answer to most people, although it's true. You can also say that it would appear that more glory accrues to God by the bringing into existence of these multitudes of individuals and the bringing of some of them to salvation than it would have if God had simply stopped the process at some particular point. But again, it's hard to give solid underlying evidence for that presentation. It's a little more satisfying to people until they start thinking it through and then ask, well, you know, and what is that based? So it really doesn't have a very satisfactory answer, because in essence we're asking, why did God do something? And unless there is a fairly clear answer in the scriptures, it's hard to speak very strongly on it. There are some philosophical suggestions that can be made to that, but they're a little involved. As to what we'll cover in 3 and 4, that remains an open question, because, you see, I hope to have a new syllabus for 3, and so we'll have to see what we'll do in 4. Under the Pelagian theory, do you notice quickly what the view holds on page 86? Adam's sin affected only himself as far as guilt or pollution. But we're only dealing with guilt here because we're talking about the imputation of Adam's sin. Now, when you talk about imputation of Adam's sin, you're talking about sin in terms of guilt. That's a special category. Imputation goes with guilt. And when you talk about the impartation of Adam's corruption, you're talking about another separate category of sin, sin in terms of depravity. So you talk about the impartation of Adam's sin, you're talking about corruption. the imputation of Adam's sin, you're talking about guilt. So here we're talking about guilt, and that's why or pollution is in parentheses here, since we're treating mainly in this section of guilt. Notice, too, ability conditions responsibility. A man is responsible only for what he's able to do. Third, man can perfectly obey God. Fourth, every man's soul is created innocent. That is, there is no such thing, five, as a sinful nature. There are only sinful actions. Adam's sin is merely a bad example to his posterity. And then, seventh, Romans 5:12 is understood to mean that as Adam sinned and died, so in like manner men die because they sin. All right? Now, if that view sounds very similar to someone that we've mentioned a couple of times in this year, I think you're correct in assuming that there is a very real similarity. Charles Finney. The view, I mean, almost position for position down the line, this expresses Finney's view. Now, notice there are a couple of comments there by way of remark. Now, going to page 87, the Arminian theory. By the way, this is not the Armenian theory. Armenia is a country, it's a nationality, it has nothing to do with a theological position. And you can't say Armenians are Arminians. That doesn't go.
The minister's life representative, Carl Sinanian, he said, I'm Armenian, but I'm Calvinist.
Okay. The Arminian theory, and we're talking here only about the imputation of Adam's guilt. This view holds that men are not guilty of Adam's sin. Men are born destitute of original righteousness and depraved. This depravity may be called sin, but it does not involve guilt or punishment. Only when men voluntarily appropriate their inborn evil tendencies are they guilty. So they do have this tendency, but only when they voluntarily appropriate it are they guilty. So guilt comes by voluntary appropriation of that inborn tendency which may be called depravity. As a matter of justice, this is an important part of the Arminian view, God bestows upon each person at birth a special influence of the Holy Spirit, which is called prevenient or preparatory grace. Prevenient or preparatory grace. Now, that preparatory grace puts man in a position in which, number six, he is fully able to obey God by cooperating with the Holy Spirit. Now, you do need, in the Arminian view, the work of the Holy Spirit. That is, a person can't just do it by prevenient grace apart from the working of the Spirit. It's a combination. And so, Romans 5:12 means that all suffer the consequences of Adam's sin in terms of depravity, in terms of the physical results of sin, and all personally consent to their inborn depravity by committing acts of sin. And so that way, they become guilty. Thiessen has a section in which he offers various considerations as to why prevenient grace is necessary to be positive. Most of them center around what Thiessen considers to be a necessity arising out of God's justice. You might want to check that out and see that. Mr. Beaver.
Is this exactly
as it has developed? Arminius was much more Calvinistic. Mr. Christian.
Do any of these views, I'm thinking the Arminian especially, hold to the impartation of Adam's sin but not the imputation of Adam's sin?
This one.
It would hold the impartation
of Adam's sin. That's why I distinguish depravity from guilt. See, they would hold to the impartation of Adam's sin, parenthesis, depravity, but not the imputation of Adam's sin, parenthesis, guilt. Okay?
Is the imputation of Adam's sin necessarily connected with the federal headship idea?
No. You find it also in the natural headship, and you find it also in immediate imputation. The last three views, you'll find it. It just is a different basis on which it's imputed in each case. The first two, it's not imputed. The last three, it is imputed. Mr. Perry.
Yeah. It seems to me that Hyde, in fact, relates to him, which is the manager of that. It seems to be a limit. Well,
Hodge has a very special position on the salvation of infants. That's all I can say. Whether it comports with the rest of his theology is an interesting question. Thirdly, the theory of mediate imputation. I have not pointed out any names, connective names with these. That's not really necessary. You will find in some of the theology works certain names associated with these views. That's part of historical theology. This view holds that all men are born physically and morally depraved. Okay, they're depraved. This depravity is the source of all actual sin and is itself sin. That is contra the Arminian view, where it is not itself sin. The body is depraved, but the soul is created wholly by God. The soul becomes corrupt by being united to the body, which is a curious kind of view. Men are guilty of Adam's sin on the basis of shared depravity. They are guilty because they are corrupt, not corrupt because they are guilty. The basis of the imputation of Adam's guilt to his descendants is that they share Adam's depravity. That's the basis of the imputation of guilt. In other words, they're guilty because they're depraved, and they inherit the depravity from Adam. And so Romans 5:12 means that all sinned by having a depraved nature. Now, the fourth view, page 88, the theory of natural headship, also called the realistic theory, or the Augustinian theory. This view holds that the human race was an organic unity in Adam. Adam was the entire race and possessed the whole human nature. The entire race sinned in Adam. Well, obviously, if he possessed the whole human nature, then the entire race sinned in Adam. And thus, the whole human nature became guilty, corrupt, and liable to death, because the whole human nature was in Adam. See? So the whole human nature became guilty itself. Individual men are particular manifestations of the universal human nature. Individual men are guilty of Adam's sin because they actually sinned in Adam, being in his loins. Thus, Adam's sin is properly our own. Now, this view goes a long way toward establishing individual human responsibility for sin. Instead of saying, he did it. How could I help it? I was born into this world. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't ask to be a sinner. I come into this world and I'm a sinner. By surprise. No, this view says, oh no, you were there. There's no slipping out of it with this view. Most of the time, people who hold the theory of natural headship would hold traducianism. Can't say all the time. All the time in theology is a hard thing to say. Mr. Dixon.
How's it different from the pre-physical soul?
Interesting question. It really doesn't hold to that, however.
How can nature sin?
Well, an interesting question. It needs further explication. They would deny pre-existence of the soul. They would say that the soul of an individual, as an individual, does not come into existence until either the point of conception or some point along before birth, even though the whole nature was in Adam. So there is a sense of pre-existence there, but it's not pre-existence of the soul. Yes. Number five, the theory of federal headship, also called the representative theory. Now, obviously, if someone says, I like that word, realistic. No. The theory of federal headship teaches that God made Adam the representative of the whole human race when he entered into the covenant of works with him. Since Adam sinned, and since Adam was truly the representative of the race, God imputes the guilt of Adam's sin to the whole race, imparts the depravity of Adam to the whole race, and condemns the whole race to death. This depravity of the nature of man leads to acts of sin and is itself sin. The impartation of depravity is not the basis of the imputation of guilt, but is just the opposite. The formula in this view is not depraved, therefore guilty, as in the immediate imputation view, but guilty, therefore depraved. So Romans 5:12 means, in this view, that we all truly sinned in the person of our representatives. Now, interestingly enough, this view also says, here is how we account for individual human responsibility. Again, it's not a case of saying, well, it's not my fault, he did it, I get the blame. In this case, Adam was truly my representative. When he sinned, I sinned. So now that notice, both in the theory of natural headship and the theory of federal headship, a great deal of effort is expended to try to fix human responsibility for sin. So that, for instance, I can't say, in either one of these views, I can't say I'm not to blame for my own sin. Nor can I say that poor helpless fellow out there with multiple sclerosis or muscular dystrophy, that poor fellow, he had no part in the results of sin in his life. I not only have to say he had a part in sin, original sin, and what flows from it, and what comes to him in his life in terms of the effects of sin, but I also, in a kind of an organic sense, I share responsibility with him for his condition. We're all in the same boat. We're all in the same boat. In some sense, I'm responsible for me, and I'm responsible for him. Okay. That was the section back pages 74 through 76. You'll probably want to look at that. Both in the theory of natural headship and the theory of federal headship, both cases, you have guilt and then depravity in both cases. And you have it both with regard to Adam and to his descendants. So there's an imputation of guilt and then depravity in both cases.
I'd also say, it's coming, I guess, righteousness is the same way. You're declared righteous, then you're made righteous.
Exactly. Precisely so. Precisely so. Well, there are some other considerations here, and there's another point on the impartation of Adam's corruption, and there's a section here on total depravity. Let me give these questions, the review questions, and then just say one further word about total depravity, which you may need to know. Mr. Rocker, the last dot to describe what is meant by total depravity. If these compartments can be considered the faculties in man's being, if you can consider, for instance, intellect and will and emotions and conscience, those four, just for an example, not as being exhaustive, but if you can consider these as the faculties of man's being, then depravity is total in extent. Total in extent. In other words, every faculty of man's being is depraved. But it is not total in degree. That is not what is meant by total depravity. So that, in other words, here's one individual who's more depraved than another. And this person can become more or less depraved. And this person can become more or less depraved. Of course, as an unregenerate person, this person will continue to have some degree of depravity and will never reach full depravity and degree in this life. And the same with this individual. But you can have differences among individuals. That's the idea of total depravity. Total in extent, not total in degree. I hope that will be helpful. Mr. Ronnie.
Can you give a name for what's represented by the space above the line?
No, I haven't thought of that. Mr. Basil. Do what? Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, some evangelicals hold every one of these views.
Can you name a contemporary or recent evangelical or systematic theology that holds the natural history view? Is there one that's more recent on Buswell or somebody? Is there anybody saying that recently?
Not recently. All right, thank you, gentlemen.